It's 74 degrees and 7:08 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. Great to be with you on a Saturday evening. We are in the process of trying to reach Professor Amar Al-Azam. I have spoken with him before. He is extremely knowledgeable on the subject of ISIS and Syria. And we're asking him about sort of what he sees could happen here. Obviously, there's so much going on in this part of the world. It is so complex with obviously the Soviet Union or Russia, standing with Bashar al-Assad, and obviously the Americans indicating that they are, well, Americans are telegraphing different things and different kinds of subjects. And we have actually reached Professor Amar al-Azam. He is with the East History and Anthropology with Shawnee State University, and we're hoping to join him here in just a few minutes. I do want to let you know that we've got much more coming on during this show. We're going to visit with an expert on Minnesota rodeo circuit. It's a big one that's coming up in this hour. And then we're also going to talk about with an expert on the cyber attack that hit Ukraine and then spread through Europe and New Jersey. And then we're also going to talk in the 8 o'clock hour about why Minnesota has the fattest cats and dogs in the country. But right now we are joined by Professor Amar al-Azam. He is a professor of anthropology with Shawnee State University, and he is an expert on Syria. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, no, thank you for inviting me.
All right. Let me ask you, I mean, so much has happened in this area of the world. So much is uncertain. What are some of the key takeaways of some of the most recent developments that you believe are really hallmarks and indicators of what might be to come in this area?
Certainly. Now, obviously, the big stories that are coming out are with regards to the, you know, the war against ISIS. We hear from Iraq that Mosul is all but fallen. And obviously, in Syria, there's the big push against Raqqa by the SDF, which is the opposition forces backed by the United States, which are made primarily of Kurdish forces with some Arab tribal groups with them. And although there's been a recent setback in the Raqqa campaign, overall, eventually ISIS will be pushed out of Raqqa. And that will only leave Deir ez-Zor, the last remaining city in Syria. So the big question here is who will take it once ISIS has been defeated, once ISIS has been pushed out of Syria, or let's say suppressed in Syria, who's going to take over this large area, piece of real estate that they controlled for so long? And this is where the real, I think, difficulties are going to come. The Kurds certainly...
Professor, if I can just ask you, I mean, hasn't that been the problem in the past where there have been these interventions by twice the United States and there have been power vacuums that have developed, the latest one that allowed ISIS to really gain this power in the first place?
Exactly. And if that is not addressed appropriately, you're going to create, and this is what I was going to say, and if that's not addressed properly, you're going to create another situation that will effectively allow for the next version, if you will, or the next reincarnation of ISIS Mark II or III to reemerge in the region again, because you're not addressing the actual core grievances, the core issues that led to the uprising in Syria and ultimately led to the formation of this very radicalized extreme group ISIS in both Syria and Iraq. And to simply just focus on one very specific aspect of the conflict, and obviously from a U.S. perspective, that ISIS is the key issue, but then ignoring what led to the formation of ISIS is in effect going to lead to the reemergence of ISIS in both Syria and Iraq, and that's really where the core problem is.
It's an enormous problem. I have covered trials here in our own state in Minnesota, where young men who were on their way to go join ISIS say they were initially attracted back in 2013 and 2014 before, you know, ISIS was really, you know, everybody knew, before people really knew how terrible they were, they were attracted to go there initially because they felt it was the right thing to do to join in this battle against the Assad regime. And so that's why they were initially lured. Of course, then, you know, we all learned about ISIS and it was clear that it was a terrorist organization. But what?
Absolutely. I mean, that goes to the core of the issue, that if effectively you allow these areas to be handed over in full or partially back to the control of the Assad regime, you're in effect recreating the same dynamics that led to the explosion of ISIS in the first place, with the added problem that the deep sectarian, extremely unpleasant narratives that have grown around ISIS and have grown around, and they're not just sectarian now you've added the ethnic component because of the enmity between the Arab tribes and the Kurds. So now you have Sunni Shiite fracture lines that are opened up. You have ethnic Arab Kurdish fracture lines that have opened up, and they're on both sides of the border, both in Iraq and in Syria. So really, you have a very volatile mix, and all you're doing is creating a very temporary sort of respite, but you have no plan to address the longer-term issues that led to this thing to develop in the first place, and I think that's going to be catastrophic. I believe that the region is in for a very, very long period of instability. And then if you look even a little further, step a little further out, and you look at the current problem between the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Qataris and Iran, it just adds to the pressure and the instability of the region.
What is your take on the military action that the U.S. took basically with airstrikes against pro-regime forces back in May, pro-Assad forces? What has been sort of the fallout from that? And what do you think that was really about?
There's been several actions that have been taken by the U.S. There was the first big one, and that was the airstrike against the airbase that essentially it was believed the sarin gas attack against Khan Sheikhoun was launched from. And again, this really proves that for many of us who've been saying this for a very long time, that action against the Assad regime does produce results. It does hold them back. It does curtail their attacks using internationally banned chemical weapons and the like. So it's unfortunate that it's taken so long for this kind of action to occur. And I think it's important that this is done, even if it's just trying to address the issue of chemical weapons and not the wider problem of indiscriminate bombardment of civilians, etc. But then there's been other actions against allied forces to the Assad regime, and most recently the downing of an Assad regime force jet. And that's more to do with trying to force the Assad forces and their allies, mainly the Iranians, away from the Iraqi border and prevent this link-up that the Iranians have long wanted between Iraq and Syria, a land bridge that maintains a continuous weapons supply to their chief ally in Lebanon, that is Hezbollah, and also gives Iran access to the Mediterranean Sea. That is a much more long-term strategic interest, and it's one that the Americans have clearly made a priority for them to prevent from happening. But unfortunately for the United States, it does not have the assets on the ground to prevent this. I mentioned earlier to you Deir ez-Zor as the last city on the Iraqi border, but the only forces available on the ground right now that are able to take such a city are the Assad forces. And as much as this really sticks in the throat of the United States, if they want to finish the job, they're going to have to let the Assad forces move, and that will put Assad and his Iranian allies right on the Iraqi-Syrian borders.
All right. Sir, we have to take a very quick break, but I would like to ask you a few more questions when we come back, specifically about the role of Russia, about the future of Bashar al-Assad. There has been speculation now for years that he eventually will have to go or perhaps will be toppled. So let's talk about that when we come back. We are chatting with Amar al-Azam. He's a professor at Shawnee State University. It is 7:19 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. We are chatting with Professor Amar al-Azam. He is a professor of anthropology with Shawnee State University and expert on Syria. Sir, what do you think when it comes to Russia and Vladimir Putin's role here? What should we know and what should we be concerned about?
Really, the primary concern for us is the fact that we spend, that is, we here in the United States, spend decades trying to keep Russian influence out of the region as a whole. And unfortunately, for a variety of different reasons, the Russians have effectively not only managed to come back into the region, but also to come back and with a very strong role to play. The realignment of the region, the new alliances that are even now emerging between Qatar and Turkey as a result of this spat between Saudi and Qatar and the Emirates, has essentially given the Russians and Vladimir Putin here a huge role, far disproportionate from what they should have been able to do in the region as a whole. Just for example, Russia now has both birthing rights and actual, if you want, bases, naval bases, all the way from the Persian Gulf, right the way around, through the Red Sea and onto Alexandria and the Syrian coast on the Mediterranean.
These are actual Russian bases?
Some of them are Russian bases, some of them are birthing rights, and in countries that are supposedly allied to us, like the Emirates, for example, that we consider to be strong allies of ours. They have birthing rights in Alexandria, in Egypt, which President Trump recently was, hosting President Sisi of Egypt and telling us what a great guy. So the dynamics and the regional, if you want, the reorganization of the region, and the role of the Russians in the region has grown exponentially, in part as a result of the conflict in Syria. The fact that we have to share operations and airspace in Syria with the Russians, and the Russians openly, after the downing of that last Syrian jet, the Russians openly said that they will consider any coalition airplane flying on the west bank of the Euphrates to be hostile. I mean, just the fact that they can now say that openly and threaten openly like that is unprecedented. And again, the ability of the Russians to work with the Iranians and allow, again, where you have this Iranian influence that's now spread and is very deeply entrenched in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon. These are, literally connecting Iran in a direct line to them from the position to the Mediterranean. This is unprecedented, and it has unraveled, if you will, decades of effort from the 70s and the 60s to keep those forces and powers out of the region.
When President Trump was a candidate, when he was running, essentially he was running on very much sort of an isolationist message to a nation that is very tired of conflicts that have consumed us, and where the U.S. has not really gotten a lot out of Iraq. There, so many Americans died fighting for cities like Mosul, and only to see them just, a few years later taken over by hostile forces. Yet the president does seem to be pivoting here, perhaps reluctantly, in an understanding that the U.S. is going to have to play some kind of role. What are your thoughts about that? And what do you see as an expert in this area?
Look, action has consequences. Nobody doubts that. And I think the Bush administration, George Bush's, the son's administration in the 2000, between 2000 and 2008, demonstrated that clearly, that when you take action, and particularly when you take action that is not very carefully planned and considered, it can have catastrophic consequences. But also we've seen with the Obama administration, which came right after the Bush administration, which was supposed to correct that issue, which was supposed to sort of push us back into the normal. And there we saw complete inaction and a total withdrawal and, in my opinion, an abrogation of our responsibilities.
Well, and the infamous red line in the sand that...
Amongst other, yes, of course. But it's not just the red line in the sand. It is the whole pullback from the region, starting with that famous speech he did in Cairo, where, if anyone was listening then, we should have all known what was coming. He clearly said, you have to learn to live with each other. You have to accept
that Iran has its own regional strategic considerations. You know, all of these, when you put them up, I mean, with hindsight, obviously, everything looks a lot clearer. But this pullback, this inaction in the region also has catastrophic consequences. The catastrophic consequences are now clear to see. The fact that we pulled out of Iraq, was that ensuring that there is a strong government that is able to take over and maintain or keep, let's say, Iranian influence out of Iraq, has had a huge catastrophic impact. It led in part to the rise of ISIS. The fact that we did nothing in Syria allowed it to become such a morass, such a toxic, terrible conflict that it has spawned, you know, not just humanitarian catastrophes and disasters, but also, you know, radical Islamic terrorist. It's become a terrorist factory in a way, that those ISIS-held areas. And, you know, again, looking at Lebanon, looking, the whole region has become disabled because of that inaction. So looking at, so if, you know, as President Trump comes in, he looks at this scene, he says, I know I promised an isolationist sort of, I mean, he's promised a lot of things, which is going to be unable. He's also promised jobs, he's also promised all sorts of stuff. But that's fine, that's campaigning. But realistically speaking, when he looks at the region and he looks at the choices he has, I can tell you that the last administration, the Obama, left him with very few viable choices in the region. And at best, he's going to have to try to minimize, if you want, or contain the damage that has been caused. And that is going to require a lot of work and a lot of input. And the idea that we can simply just continue as we were before is just not sustainable. We're going to have to engage in that region. And in maybe not exactly the same way that the two previous administrations did or did not, but there's going to have to be engagement and probably boots on the ground for the foreseeable future, too.
Is there some leader that is sort of waiting in the wings in exile that perhaps, you know, in terms of, you know, the Syrian leadership, that could perhaps be somebody who could, you know, change things?
We often joke amongst ourselves, as Syrians, that the Syrian revolution was was, because it's
not. Having a little trouble hearing you, sir.
Sorry, I said the Syrian revolution. We joke amongst ourselves and say that it's the orphaned revolution. It's because it's leaderless and basically seems to lack any direction. Ideally, in an ideal world, we would have had a Nelson Mandela who would have been able to sort of step in and take over. But I think a conflict like this, because of the extreme nature, because of the violence, because of the radicalization, because of the brutality, it's really become so toxic. I think it's very, very hard to put anything back together again. And I cannot even. I don't have a formula or a vision for now anymore for what a post-conflict Syria might look like. We're going to have to, you know, make this as we go along. I think the damage is too deep and has gone on for too long. But I do know one thing for sure, that as long as you keep Assad in power, or permit him to exercise the kind of power that he's been able to exercise, and with the kinds of resources he's had available, I'm thinking here mainly of the Iranian forces and Iranian-backed forces that are in the country, then this conflict is just going to go on and on and on. And I think a first step would be to, if you will, bring down the level of violence, contain Assad and Assad's ability to inflict violence on people, and also push out or force the Iranians out of the area. Then you can begin this very slow process of healing, reconciliation, etc.
Well, we can only hope, sir. Professor, thank you so much for joining us. This is such a troubling and difficult topic, and you know, we can only hope that those kinds of things perhaps might happen someday. Thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, folks. Such a difficult situation, and so heartbreaking, and so many people displaced, the brutality, the refugees, the lost lives, American lives, Syrian lives. It's really just a situation that seems to have no end in sight when we consider it. All right, folks, we are going to shift gears, and I think we probably need to shift gears here. Coming up in our next half hour, we are going to talk about the active rodeo circuit in Minnesota. You know, when you think of the rodeo, you don't really maybe think of Minnesota, but there is a very active one, and there is the Hamel Rodeo, which starts this Wednesday in Corcoran. So we're going to visit with Ruth Nicholas. She's a spokesperson for the Hamel Rodeo, and we're going to talk to her about the rodeo circuit here in our region. Keep it right here, folks. We're going to take a quick break and give you some weather first, though.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is 7:35 in the Twin Cities. Well, I love this time of year because there's so much going on. There are all these festivals and county fairs. It's all leading to the big finale, I feel, which is, of course, the Minnesota State Fair. But this Wednesday, there is a very special event that starts this Wednesday in Corcoran. It's called the Hamel Rodeo. And joining us to talk about it is Ruth Nicholas. And Ruth, am I saying your name correctly?
Yes, ma'am, you are, and thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. All right, Ruth, tell us about the Corcoran Radio, and just tell us about the status of radio in Minnesota, because I was not aware that this is, it's big here. I mean, you think of rodeo, you think of probably Texas or Oklahoma, but I understand that there are a lot of rodeo fans right here.
You are exactly right. And the Hamel Rodeo, which really kicks off Thursday night, not Wednesday night, and runs through Sunday, is the largest pro rodeo in the state of Minnesota. And we'll see upwards of 500 cowboys and cowgirls competing, and they'll be from all over the nation. And yes, there are quite a few rodeo cowboys and cowgirls in Minnesota. You wouldn't think that, but it's true. There's a lot of horses in Minnesota.
Absolutely. And Corcoran, not that far away from the Twin Cities. I mean, just a very short drive. So how many fans are you expecting?
We'll see 18,000 people over 5 days.
Wow.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Yeah. This is a big one. And we'll pay out, oh, geez, I think last year when the competition is over, we'll pay out over $100,000 to those cowboys and cowgirls who have won, who are garnering points to go on to Pro Rodeo's World Championship, which is the national finals rodeo held in Las Vegas every December.
Wow. Okay, so this starts, it starts Thursday night and then goes through Sunday. Break it down for us on what some of the events are, and it's obviously a lot of people, 18,000 fans are expected. Break us down some of the events that will be taking place.
This rodeo is sanctioned by the PRCA, which stands for Pro Rodeo Cowboys Association. And there are 12 PRCA rodeos in the state of Minnesota. We are one of those. Every PRCA rodeo has 7 different events: bareback riding, tie down roping, team roping, steer wrestling, saddle bronc riding, ladies barrel racing, and then we wrap up every night with everybody's favorite, the bull riding. And those cowboys and cowgirls will compete in one of those, one or two, usually just one of those events, and then they're on down the road to the next rodeo.
Okay.
So our fans, you see the same events every performance, every night, different cowboys and cowgirls every night.
Right. And you're giving out $100,000 in prize money?
Yeah. Yes.
Wow. Okay. Yes. And are most, you said the people are coming from all over the country. How many of these sort of major rodeos, you mentioned that there are a number of other, you know, sanctioned rodeos right here in Minnesota, but it sounds like this is the biggest one. But how many rodeos can somebody compete in if they wanted to compete, you know, around all year?
You know, honestly, Esme, you could go to this time of year, you could go to a rodeo every day. And of course, in the off season, which is probably October through about March, you could hit a rodeo almost every weekend. There are 600 PRCA rodeos across the nation. And right now, those cowboys, we call this Cowboy Christmas. This is the busiest and richest time of the year because of the 4th of July. There's so many rodeos going on that these cowboys and cowgirls will compete in Hamel. Then they'll be off to, there's a rodeo in Spooner, Wisconsin that the next day, Isandy, Minnesota, they'll be going to Cheyenne Frontier Days. I mean, they go hard because it's all counted by dollars. So the more rodeos you go to, the more money you have a chance of winning and the better chance you have of qualifying for the national finals rodeo.
Wow. Okay. So how does somebody apply to actually be in the Hamel Radio or rodeo? I mean, I guess you can't just say, oh, I'm going to try and do it. You have to have sort of a track record, don't you?
Exactly. And a lot of our cowboys and cowgirls started when they were little kids. Maybe they had moms or dads who competed in rodeo. Maybe they got interested through friends. There is a really strong, in Minnesota, a really strong Little Britches Rodeo Association, which is exactly Little Britches. It's for ages 4, I believe, through 18. And those kids will compete in Little Britches Rodeo. They'll compete in the Minnesota Junior High School Rodeo Association. They'll graduate onto the Minnesota High School Association.
Wow.
And a lot of those kids will get rodeo scholarships to attend college, which is a real blessing because they can pay for part of their schooling rodeo while collegiately and then earn their degree.
And I was not aware that there were rodeo scholarships. How many schools offer rodeo scholarships?
I don't know an exact number. I would say in Minnesota, I don't know, but I would say across the nation, a lot of them. A lot of the community colleges, a lot of the colleges in Nebraska, Oklahoma, Texas, you know, as you go farther south and west where you can rodeo during the winter, the only disadvantage to Minnesota is you cannot rodeo during the winter because it's cold and your arenas are covered with snow. You can have an indoor arena where you might practice and hold rodeos, but a lot of those college rodeo programs are in the south and the west where you can rodeo year-round.
Absolutely. And I imagine, I mean, I don't have any friends in rodeo that I know of, but I do have friends that do ride and show horses.
Sure.
And it is not a cheap thing to own and have a championship horse. And I imagine that is very much the case with your sport as well. I imagine to have a top horse, you have to have a top rider, but to have a top horse, that's a pretty expensive endeavor, isn't it?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Especially for the tie-down roping, the team roping, the steer wrestling, and the barrel racing. You know, if you're going to compete at the top echelon among those top cowboys and cowgirls, your horse might be upwards of six figures. So it is not a cheap endeavor. And then, you know, you need a trailer and a truck to haul it and your expenses on the road. But the memories, the miles, the friends, I mean, it's really worth it. There's really a sense of camaraderie among rodeo competitors and even among rodeo fans. Where else can you see, you know, sort of a tip of the hat to the old West and the Americana lifestyle with the Hamel Rodeo?
Right, absolutely. And we're going to get into more details here in just a little bit. Let me ask you, I mean, it does look very, very dangerous. Are there a lot of injuries?
You know, parts of it are dangerous, parts are not. For the bull riding, those cowboys who ride bulls, if they were not riding bulls, they would be motocross driving, they would be jumping out of airplanes. I mean, they're looking for that adrenaline rush, and they're going to get it one way or another, and they have just chosen to do the bull riding part of it. But I wouldn't say it's any more dangerous than playing football.
There you go.
Honestly, it's not any more dangerous than getting out of bed in the morning. And, I mean, crossing the street, you know, you take chances no matter what you do. But if you love it and your heart's in it and it's your passion, you don't worry about those chances. You just live life.
There you go. All right. If you want information about the Hamel Rodeo, the best thing, they've got a great website, hamelrodeo.org. And it is in Corcoran. It looks like Thursday, it's at 7:30, Friday, 7:30, July 8th, looks like it's 1 o'clock on. Is that like a full day of events?
No, there's two rodeos on Saturday, next Saturday. 1 o'clock performance is what we call family day, and all tickets are $10. So if your wallet is feeling a little weak these days and you want to bring the whole crew out, your family and your kids and the in-laws, that's the day to come. Saturday afternoon at 1, then we have a Saturday night performance as well, and Sunday night too.
Okay. And then for each of these days, do we see all of the events or do you just see some events on some days and other events on other days?
You will see all the events, every performance, different cowboys and cowgirls, every performance.
Got it. Okay. And the information is there. And any specific, you know, instructions about sort of like where to drive or park or that kind of thing? Because you got a lot of people coming.
Yeah, parking's free. We've got vendors out there, so you can have a burger or a brat or cotton candy or whatever. But I have to say, Esme, this rodeo is a not-for-profit venture. It started 36 years ago, and since it started, we've given $1.8 million back to the community through different charity organizations. So you come out, you have a good time, you enjoy your evening under the stars. That's so cool to see the stars blinking up there. But then you're making the world a better place because you know the profits from the rodeo go back to the community.
Wow. So where do the profits go? Right back into the Corcoran area?
Yes, they go to five organizations in the area. They go to the Hamel Lions Club, the Hamel Volunteer Fire Department, the John Poker Legion Post, the Heinz and Ditter, a VFW post, excuse me. And then this year, we've got a new organization, the Military Family Support Ministry. So it's going to make lives better for Lions Club, VFD, Legion, Volunteer Fire Department, all those people.
Very cool. Okay, listen, we have to take a quick break. I got some more questions, though, for Ruth. She is the spokesperson for the Hamel Rodeo Thursday night, folks, Thursday through Sunday in Corcoran. Let's take a quick break. More questions about the Hamel Rodeo after this on News Radio 830 WCCO. It is 747, 75 degrees, chatting with Ruth Nicholas. She's the spokesperson for the Hamel Rodeo, which begins this Thursday in Corcoran. They are expecting 18,000 fans Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Ruth, I don't know if you told me this, but how many cowboys and cowgirls are you expecting to take part?
You know, I haven't looked at the list lately, but I think there's upwards of 500 on there.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
And do you have any idea or ballpark how many are from the Minnesota or our region?
You know, I don't know either. I'd say there's probably 10%.
Wow, so okay.
That's pretty high number.
Right. And obviously, as you mentioned, there is a disadvantage because unless you have a big indoor ring, it's hard to practice here in Minnesota because of our winter weather. Are all the contestants at sort of the professional level who'll be competing, or do you have some, like, do you have a beginner class or a youth class that are competing?
No, these are all pros. You have, for the cowboys, for the men, you have to be a member of the PRCA, the Pro Rodeo Cowboys Association, to compete. And for the women, you have to be a member of the WPRA, Women's Pro Rodeo Association. Now,
wow.
Now you keep in mind, some of these cowboys and cowgirls do this for a living. That's how they make their living, is rodeoing. But there's also a set of them who only, we sometimes call weekend warriors. They'll hold down a 40-hour-a-week job.
Wow.
But then they have the freedom to rodeo on the weekends. And they'll be the ones who don't get as far from home. Maybe they've got family commitments or job commitments. They may hit two or three rodeos a weekend, where the pros who are doing it for a living will hit three, four, or five rodeos a week.
Wow. Okay. And you said this is really a year-round circuit?
Yeah, you know, it slows down quite a little. I shouldn't even say quite a little bit. It slows down December, January. But in December, the Wrangler National Finals Rodeo takes place in Las Vegas, and it is the championship, the world championship for the PRCA. So there's very few rodeos that month. But actually in January, it kicks right back up, and people are usually going hard again on down the road.
Right. And as for the horses, is it mostly quarter horses, or what kind of horses are used mostly in rodeos?
Yeah. Almost all quarter horses for the timed events, which is the roping and the steer wrestling and the barrel racing, just because of their speed and athleticism.
All right.
So, yeah, mostly quarters.
And how about the bulls? I mean, how do you get bulls from one rodeo to another? Maybe that's a dumb question, but I just was wondering.
That's an excellent question. Those bucking bulls are bred to buck. It's just like a horse in the Kentucky Derby. You don't take a horse out of your backyard and say, wow, I think I'm going to run him in the Derby. They are bred to buck, and the man who owns these bulls that will come to Hamel is out of Montana. It's J. Bar J. Rodeo Company, and he has a program where he owns the bulls and the horses, the bucking horses, and takes them from rodeo to rodeo across the nation. And let me tell you that those horses and bulls are treated better than some people I know, because they're very valuable as well. They can be five-digit, you know, they can cost five digits and six digits, too.
Wow. Okay. And these are the classic bucking broncos, but they are literally bred to buck? I mean, are they trained? Or?
Yeah. You know, it's hard to train a horse or a bull to buck. If they don't want to buck, you can't make them.
I've never tried, so.
Yeah, well, you know, if you got a horse, before you can ride a horse, it has to be broken to ride, trained to ride. But there are the occasional outlaw horses that just can't be trained to ride. They won't let you put a saddle on them. They won't let you swing a leg over them. And that's where they come from. I mean, that's where they go. Instead of going to the glue factory, they go to a rodeo outfit that can use them at a rodeo. So, and you think about horses, a bucking horse ride or a bull ride is 8 seconds at a time, and they'll buck once a weekend, maybe twice. So they live pretty good lives where you work 8 seconds or 16 seconds a weekend, which isn't too bad.
Well, yes. Now, and how about, I mean, because I know that we have a lot of animal lovers out there. I mean, are there injuries to them and to the bulls?
Occasionally, just from living life. I mean, just from normal stuff.
Right.
But when you have an animal that might be worth $10,000 or up, you're going to make sure that animal is well taken care of. And we always have a veterinarian on site for the entire rodeo. So that person, you know, of course, who has his degree and who is or she is knowledgeable, is there to take care of any injuries that might happen.
Wow. Okay. And even these bucking bulls, you said, are worth that much money because they've got to have that in them. And so they're on the circuit, too.
Yeah, you're exactly right. They're on the circuit, too. Unlike the cowboys who will stay for one performance and go on to the next rodeo, those bulls and horses will stay for the entire week in Hamel, and then they'll go off to their next rodeo, wherever they might be.
Wow, okay. And you mentioned that there are other rodeos in Minnesota, but this is the biggest.
This is the biggest when you're counting by the purse money, which is that $100,000 that we will pay out, and by number of contestants that we have, too. So, yeah, this is the biggest rodeo in the state.
And let me ask you this about, are some of these people, on this tour with their families?
Sometimes. It depends. If you've got kiddos, you know, for kids, they love to go on the rodeo road because it's fun. I mean, you're outside and you're with friends and you're with mom and dad, and it's almost like a mini vacation for them. Sometimes wives have to stay home because they've got jobs, or maybe the kids are really little, or your kids are old enough that they're playing ball and you can't get away. But there is no better life for a family than being on the road together. It's like a mini vacation all the time.
All right. I think I can hear a horse in the background. Okay.
Yeah.
So is each rodeo show sort of pretty much similar with all these different events?
Yes. Any pro rodeo will have those same seven events. And a lot of those cowboys and cowgirls will compete at the same rodeo. So they'll see each other from night to night or town to town. So there's a lot of friendships that are formed on the rodeo road.
Wow.
Cowboys and cowgirls are independent contractors, meaning they can choose to enter whatever rodeo they want to. So they may go, you know, to a rodeo in Hamel, and then they may turn around and the next day be at a rodeo in Colorado. So there's a lot of driving involved, but it also makes for a strong sense of family because you'll see a lot of these same people at different rodeos.
And what percentage are men, like, do you have any idea, like, in terms of the 500 or so cowboys and cowgirls that are planning to compete for $100,000 in prize money in Corcoran for the Hamel Rodeo, what percentage are women, I mean, cowgirls?
Well, out of seven events, only one is a women's event. So
okay.
About one-seventh of them are women. You know, that's probably a little low. It's probably closer to...
And that's the barrel race.
Probably closer to one-tenth because there's a lot... Yeah, in the barrel racing, exactly. Because there's a lot more barrel racers than, like, say, bareback riders. Especially in Minnesota. There's a lot of horses in the state of Minnesota.
That are barrel racers.
Yes, that are barrel racing horses, yes.
All right. Well, it sounds like a fun time in Corcoran, Ruth Nicholas. Anyway, so it starts on this Thursday at 7:30, right?
Yes, ma'am. We run Thursday, Friday, Saturday afternoon and evening, and then Sunday evening. And there's vendors, and we do a parade on Sunday afternoon, and there's dances following the rodeo. So we like to make it not just the rodeo, but a whole experience.
Wow. It certainly sounds great. And all the information on your website, hamelrodeo.org, I believe, right?
Yes, ma'am. You've got it.
Okay. Thank you so much. Take care.
My pleasure.
All right, folks. I want to let you know that it is 7:56 in the Twin Cities. Your WCCO-TV time check, McCarthy Auto World, where you can save 20% off MSRP on select Buick LaCrosses. Well, that's really interesting. I didn't realize the extent of the rodeo scene here in Minnesota. I certainly didn't realize that this event has $100,000 in prize money. And you can see it right here in Corcoran, which is not that far away. So that'll be kind of cool to see and maybe check out. All right. Well, coming up here on this Saturday night in our 8 o'clock hour, normally we have Professor David Schultz on with us, but he is taking a well-deserved break. We're going to chat with Greg Scott. He is the author of Bullseye Breach about the latest cyber attack. It's called ransomware. It hit the Ukraine. It also hit Europe and even New Jersey. What you need to know, what happened, are they making advances on this? And then, why does Minnesota have the fattest cats and dogs in the entire country? We'll talk with a veterinarian. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO.